From Santa Barbara, California, Timeless Voyager Radio with Bruce Stephen Holmes. Self-development radio for the open mind. Interviews with leading-edge authors and speakers in the fields of environmental issues, alternative health care, new psychology, psychic phenomena, UFOs, and extraterrestrial encounters. And now, Bruce Stephen Holmes for Timeless Voyager Radio.
Hello, everyone. This is Bruce Stephen Holmes for Timeless Voyager Radio. My guest today is Raymond E. Fowler. He is an author and speaker. The book, though, we're going to talk about today, The Allagash Abductions. It is a book published by Wildflower Press out of Oregon. What really separates these abductions, and of course, for those of you who may have just tuned in, we're going to talk about UFO type abductions. But you know what's interesting about the book, folks, and I had a chance to read this. This abduction story, and we're going to talk to Ray about this. As a matter of fact, we're going to have a chance to talk to three, possibly four, of the abductees today. But in 1976, four men, including a pair of twins, were in the Allagash wilderness of northern Maine, and they were abducted by strange alien beings. What's interesting about it is that their personal accounts, through hypnosis, as I understand it, were corroborated. That means that four people told the same basic story. Well, that gives you a little bit of an idea of how this is going to go today. Without any further delay, I want to introduce all of you to Ray Fowler. Ray, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Bruce. It's a pleasure to be with you.
All right, Ray, why don't we start with just, I think, a very, very good beginning here. How did you become interested in this UFO phenomena?
It goes way back to 1947. As a teenager, I was interested in the development of the V-2 rockets that we had captured from the Germans, interplanetary travel, experimental aircraft, and just as a hobby, collecting items on these subjects. And then in July of 1947, while working on a farm, flying disc myself, which really piqued my interest. And it wasn't long before we found out that not only our government, but other governments were investigating these strange objects, which I had thought might be experimental aircraft. And so my interest in the subject went on for years. I did a tour with the United States Air Force and learned a little bit about the seriousness that our government took concerning the phenomenon. And after I got out, decided to become a UFO researcher and got involved with a number of national organizations. And currently I'm serving on the board of directors as director of investigations for an international organization called the Mutual UFO Network. So it's been an evolution from personal interest in things like this and personal experience, and then it evolved as the years went on.
You've written six other books, haven't you?
Yes, I have.
Why don't we just tell our listeners the names of those kind of interesting things? Well, I'll tell them. UFOs, Interplanetary Visitors, you wrote that in 1974. The Andresen Affair, we won't talk too much about these, but just the idea that that was in 79. Casebook of a UFO Investigator in 81. The Melchizedek Connection in 81. The Andresen Affair Phase 2. That was in 82, The Watchers in 1990, and most recently, The Allagash Abductions here in 1993. So you've got quite a background of information.
Yes, those books are based on thoroughly investigated UFO reports and experiences. In fact, The Allagash Abductions is based on a 10-volume, 702-page report and a 2-year investigation.
All right, now let's talk specifically about the Allagash abductions. Why don't we just get a little set the stage here. When did it happen, and what is the Allagash?
Well, the Allagash is a wilderness waterway about 92 miles long that stretches from northern Maine up to the near the Canadian border. The incident took place on August 26, 1976. Four art students decided to get together and have an adventure and camp along the Allegash waterway. And in the evening, at one of the campsites, they decided to do some night fishing because they had run out of meat. So they built this huge bonfire, which was set to last maybe a couple of hours, and paddled out onto the flooded portion of the river. And basically what happened, an object larger than a house appeared from over the trees and hovered. One of the individuals flashed his flashlight at it. A beam of light, a cone-shaped beam of light, came out of the object, and then the object began moving toward the canoe. When the beam of light hit the water, it circumscribed a circle. It looked like an outer ring with a dark center, like the beam was hollow. This was enough for the four, and they began paddling crazily for the shore toward the bonfire. Meanwhile, the objects proceeded toward them, and the beam engulfed the canoe, and the next thing they knew, they were standing by the canoe on the shore, watching the object go off in a step-like motion, and went back to their camp in a disoriented manner. They didn't know what happened. The fire was gone. The fire that they had been paddling toward, seemingly just a minute or so ago, was down to just a few embers. And that really would set the stage for what happened next. I can continue on how I managed to hear about this, the investigation, but that's the initial sighting prior to investigation and hypnosis.
All right, so before we talk more about that, I think the next question I'd like to maybe put towards you is, we've got the term UFO, which is unidentified flying object. What kinds of UFO sightings do you feel are reported these days?
Well, Dr. Jalen Hynek, who was the chief scientific science advisor to the Air Force Project's Signed Grudge and Blue Book, stated that there were a number of types of UFO sightings, which he categorized as nocturnal lights, lights which be formed in such a way that they would rule out natural phenomena or man-made objects, daylight disks, objects that were seen in the daylight that didn't conform to the aerodynamic characteristics or performance of an aircraft, conventional shape. Radar visual sightings, where such objects were seen simultaneously with the human eye and with radar equipment. And then the close encounters, which are the most important. Close encounters of the first kind, where a object is seen within 500 feet of an observer. Close encounters of the second kind, where the object leaves physical evidence behind, or there are physical effects associated with the object. Close encounters of the third kind, where an unusual non-human entity is seen in or in association with the object. And close encounters of the fourth kind, where the entities interface with human beings. Usually an abduction takes place during a close encounter of the fourth kind.
All right, now, in your study, and of course I want to mention to those of you who are listening, this is Bruce Stephen Holmes, Timeless Voyager Radio. We are talking today with Ray Fowler, and most importantly, what we are talking about is a book which he has written about an experience. Four gentlemen have had this experience. The book is called The Allegash Abductions. Well, let's start this way. How is it that you became involved with this particular information?
Well, I first heard about it in May of 1988 after giving a UFO lecture not too far from Boston. One of the abductees, doctors advised him to attend and tell me about the UFO experience. This abductee, Jim Wiener, had described the experience to his doctor, and the doctor felt that it might be an abduction experience. And when the doctor heard that I was going to be speaking in the area, he advised Jim to attend and tell me about the UFO experience that he shared with his twin brother and two friends while camping in August of 1976 along the Allegash River. And that's how I first heard about it.
And for our listeners, why don't you just name the four people so they have an idea of what we're going to be going through today?
Well, you have Jim and Jack Weiner, identical twins. We have Chuck Rack, and we have Charlie Foltz. All of them attended art school together, and were good buddies.
And I think they're all still artists, aren't they?
That's right.
All right. Now, why don't you kind of give us a little bit of a background then as to how they began to realize that they had had the abduction experience, and then, of course, we'll ask them firsthand.
Well, I might do that by just describing how we investigated this and other cases. Of course, the first thing we did was interview, other than Jim that I'd already interviewed, I interviewed the other witnesses by phone, and we had them fill out special forms that had been prepared for by the Mutual UFO Network. We checked their story with the forest ranger where they had camped, and talked to others who they had told the account to after they returned home from the camping trip. Conducted a detailed character reference check of all the four witnesses. And then we conducted 12 hypnosis sessions between 1989 and 1990.
Now, let me interrupt you one second, Ray. Why, I think people are going to wonder, so let's get this out of the way. Why is there such a difference in time? Why did this happen in 76, but nothing gets going until 88?
Because I never reported it to anybody officially until 1988.
So they kept this to themselves?
They kept it to themselves, except for a few friends and their mother and father. The twins told their mother and father when they got back. But they never did anything about it. They always were confused about the missing time, and some of them had dreams of strange entities and being in a strange place, but they never did anything about it. If it wasn't for Jim's doctor insisting that he go and hear my presentation and try to talk to me afterwards, no one would have known about this.
So their experience was one of missing time. Is that right?
Well, they had a UFO close encounter of the first kind, and that turned out to be a close encounter of the fourth kind.
I guess what I'm getting at here is that from their perception, did any one of them actually have a conscious experience, or were they all seeing this as missing time in the beginning?
They had a conscious experience of canoeing and the UFO, and the UFO closing on the canoe with the beam, and the beam hitting the canoe. And suddenly being at shore and the bonfire died down and watching the object go off, that was a conscious part of it. And some of them had dreams and flashback of strange entities and a strange place that they had been. And during the hypnotic regression sessions, all four, went through that conscious part, but when the beam hit the canoe, each one of them went up the beam into the craft and was subjected to physical examinations, and during the physical examinations, sperm was removed. Now, some people might say, well, these people must be crazy, but one of the things we did in continuing what we did in our investigation, we administered psychological profile tests to all four. We also obtained medical records to check out physical evidence on one of the twins, and actually performed three polygraph tests on each of two of the witnesses that live near Boston, and checked their encounter, or the details of their encounter, with a statistical study of over 200 other cases. So an astrophysicist and myself investigated the case with a professional hypnotist, and we sort of gave it the FBI treatment. That's about all we can do. You can't really go back there and see the event take place. But we can treat the case just as, say, the FBI would treat a criminal case, and investigate it in that way.
Now, it's my understanding, was this Dr. Bullard we're talking about?
Dr. Bullard did the statistical study, yes.
All right, he broke this down into a very interesting 8 parts, and I'd like to mention those. Basically, he found that there's an ideal pattern for this type of abduction, and he broke it down this way. One, first, there's the capture, then there's the examination, there's the conference, number 4 is a tour, 5 is otherworldly journey, 6 is a theophany, 7 is a return, and 8 is the aftermath. Now, of course, I went through that quickly. Maybe you could elaborate on that.
Well, a capture is usually the initial part of the UFO sighting, that's an intrusion into a person's environment. In the case of the Allagash group, it was while they were in a canoe peacefully fishing. And then usually there's a zone of strangeness, strange effects are experienced, and this happened, of course, when the beam hit the canoe. They felt effects that they had never experienced before, and then also allied with the capture is the time lapse or missing time or amnesia is experienced. When you get to the next one, I guess procurement, usually, but not always, a beam of light strikes and immobilizes the witness, and a drawing force pulls the witness up through the beam of light into the craft, and then alien entities appear and converse with the witness, not audibly, but through what we might call, for a better want of a term, mental telepathy. At least the abductees know exactly what they're supposed to do. And there are physical and mental controls exerted on the witness. The things that they're asked to do, they would never do under normal conditions. They are sort of anesthetized mentally, otherwise they would be in trauma. But somehow or other, a control is put over the witness, so he or she just goes along with what he or she is asked to do. And then the witness experiences what we call doorway amnesia. He doesn't remember even how he got on board the UFO. All of a sudden, he's there, and he has no memories regarding how he got there. He doesn't know where he is or what's going on. Examination, they go through a preparation. According to Dr. Bullard, manual examination, and of course this happened to the Allagash group, scanning with what you might say an optical-like device, instrumental examination by various tools, biological samples, hair, feces, sperm, and so forth are removed, examination of reproduction, reproductive organs, and then some, but not all, there's a conference where the abductee is instructed by the aliens to given a message and to release the message when the time is right. Now, this didn't happen, as far as we know, with the Allagash abduction. And a tour, sometimes the abductee is given a tour of the craft, and this didn't happen either, although they went from room to room. And very few have the otherworldly or theophany experience. Those two are usually significantly missing from Dr. Bullard's study, but then he gets to the return. And interestingly enough, the return is usually a mirror image of the capture. In fact, when they were returned to the canoe, they were put in the canoe exactly where they were seated, and the canoe was brought right up close to the shore so they could get out. And this happens over and over again. So when they got out of the canoe feeling very disoriented, they had no idea of what happened. Then usually what happens, you have an aftermath. There are immediate effects like cuts or scrapes or punctures. Then there are intermediate effects, psychological stress, latent memories of the abduction, dreams, for example, memory flashbacks. And unfortunately, sometimes there are long-term effects with the aftermath. There is periodic or continual paranormal phenomena happening, like out-of-the-body experiences, poltergeist phenomena, in some cases, strange people on the property that they don't know who they are, what they're doing there, strange things happening with the phone, and repeat abductions. So basically, those are that's the ideal abduction pattern that Dr. Bullard found in over 200 cases. And I might add that in the last 6 months to a year, I've got about 1,500 to 2,000 letters, and I would say probably over 90% of them have to do with people who feel they've had this experience, and they too reflect these benchmarks, you might say, of the abduction experience.
All right, now for those of you who are listening, Bruce Stephen Holmes, Timeless Voyager Radio. My guest today, Ray Fowler. He is, well, let me tell you a little bit about the gentleman. His career includes service with the USAF Security Service and with GTE Strategic Systems Division. He retired early as a task manager and a senior planner involved with major weapons system development. Folks, he even constructed and operates the Woodside Planetarium and Observatory out there in Massachusetts. Is that right?
That's correct.
All right, what we're going to do is let's bring the other three guests on, and they will include Jack Weiner, his brother Jim Weiner, and Charlie Foltz. Unfortunately, we're unable to get Chuck Rack, who was the fourth in this group, but we are going to bring them on right now at this moment. All right, as promised, I have on the line with me Charlie Foltz, Jack Weiner, and Jim Weiner. They are three of the four men. The fourth is, of course, Chuck Rack. He was unable to participate today. Welcome to the show, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bruce.
And, of course, Ray, you're still on the other line. Is that correct?
I'm still here, Bruce.
All right, Charlie Foltz, let's start with you. What do you first remember after being taken aboard the UFO?
Well, my first immediate memory upon opening my eyes was staring at my feet and feeling a bit confused, wondering where my socks and shoes were, and then I noticed that my legs were bare. As I looked at myself, I realized that I was naked and lying flat on a table. And I was like shocked, and then all of a sudden, anxious, frightened. And well, you well might imagine, I started struggling to get up off the table or to move. I didn't realize it was on a table, just on my back, when all of a sudden a face leaned forward at the top of my head, staring right into my eyes, which was one of the aliens and the first one that I saw. At which point, I just totally panicked, just was totally frightened almost to death, and tried backing away through the table. And the being, as it looked into my eyes, I had the sensation that you would experience going down a roller coaster or a real sharp drop in an elevator, where your stomach would lift up momentarily. My conscious thinking mind went straight up into these eyes. It like fell upwards. And my mind was in communication with this being. It told me not to be afraid, to relax and to cooperate, that I was not in any danger. At which point I ceased my struggle.
All right, let's stop with that, okay, just for a second. Jack, how did you feel when the beam of light engulfed the canoe?
It was a very strange sensation, because it's very difficult to describe. It wasn't like a feeling. It's the beam was coming up behind us very rapidly behind the canoe, and it was obvious that this beam was going to engulf us. When it did so, it was as if everything around us disappeared, because I couldn't see through this light. It was all I was aware of was the immediate vicinity of the canoe, the people in the canoe, and this incredibly bright light surrounding the canoe with this bright object directly above us. And that was the last thing I remembered. It wasn't like a feeling of floating or anything like that. I kind of had this feeling as if like I was coming apart. Is about the only way I can describe it. But it wasn't something that I was aware of consciously. The beam got to us for a few seconds. It was above us. There was a lot of confusion in the canoe, and then the next thing I knew, I was on board this thing.
All right, let's jump to Jim. You, what was your reaction at this point?
Okay.
My reaction initially was one of fright, total and absolute terror. I felt as if a button had been pressed, because which I thought was really strange, because up to that point we remained fairly curious about this thing. We weren't really frightened at first. We watched it for a few minutes before it even came out to us, and the feeling was more of curiosity than anything else. But as soon as the beam got up to our canoe and struck me, it was just like somebody pressed a switch, and I felt totally terrified. Well, one of the things that we noticed right after the incident was when we got back to our campsite, we had left maybe 15 minutes, at least it seemed to us to be only 15 or at the most 20 minutes between the time we left the camp and the time we got back. And we had built a large, very large bonfire, because up there at night it's pitch dark. You literally cannot see your hand in front of your face. And we had planned on going clear across the lake to do our fishing. So we built a very, very large campfire to use as a beacon to find our way back to the campsite. Well, after we returned to our campsite, remember, we think only a few minutes went by, and all that was left of the campfire was embers. So we knew that there was something odd here, that the campfire could not have possibly burned down in that short a time. What was strange was we really didn't seem that concerned about it. We were in a state of, I think, shock, because we didn't really sit around and try to figure out, okay, what happened to the campfire. All we wanted to do was crawl into our sleeping bags and go to sleep.
All right, let's go to Jack for a minute. What do you first remember after being taken aboard the aircraft or the spacecraft or the UFO, whatever we want to call this thing?
Well, it's pretty much similar to what Charlie had said. The first thing I remember was I opened my eyes. I was in a very brightly lit room. It was hazy. There were no details. It was very foggy, it seemed, but very bright. And the first thing I noticed is that I was laying on my back completely naked. The next thing I noticed, I wondered where the other guys were, and I looked to my left, and I noticed they were sitting on some kind of a bench of some kind that came out from this haze, and the three of them were sitting on this bench completely naked. And I was just laying there trying to figure out what was going on, but found that I couldn't move. All I could move was my eyes. And that was the first thing that happened upon waking up on this craft.
All right, how about you, Charlie? What did the entities do to you, the alien entities?
Well, after I was told to relax and not to fight them any longer, they began a series of examinations of me, physical examinations, including the taking of fluid samples, including semen, blood, and other invasive and non-invasive examination, including some sort of a panel which seemed to be hovering above my chest, which I could only see the bottom of, and it emitted a bluish light which cast down across my upper torso. My limbs were moved. I was checked for like flexibility and rotation of all my joints and so on. It seemed like you were like putty, almost like in where you were being manipulated during this examination process. So.
Let me put that to each one of you. Jack, what about you? What do you remember?
Well, I also remember some invasive procedures. They seemed to be very curious about how my joints work. They lifted my left arm and worked the joints of that. They were curious about my toes and feet. They seemed to be curious about my skin. They had this type of tool, and it's very difficult to describe, except it was like a little scoop thing that they would, in different parts of my body, they seemed to be taking scrapings or skin samples or something. They were interested in little scrapings of skin off different parts of my body. And they were also interested in taking samples of fluid, urine samples. I think they took a sperm sample. They took samples of feces. You know, they pretty much treated me the way we would treat any animal that we would catch from the wild, to inspect them and test them and weigh them. And it seemed to be that same type of procedure.
Jim, what about you? Can you describe maybe the UFO and the entities also?
By describing the UFO, you mean from the outside or the inside or both ways?
Let's talk about the outside and the inside, and of course the entities especially.
Okay, the outside basically appeared to us as a very large, round, and very bright, a whitish yellow sphere. And it reminded me of almost like a little miniature sun. The quality of the light that emanated from this object, it wasn't like the type that comes from a spotlight. It moved. It almost looked like a plasma. I don't know if you've ever, or the listeners have ever seen a pottery kiln, the inside of a pottery kiln when it's at about 2300 or 2500 degrees Fahrenheit, but it has a certain movement to it. It's almost like a plasma. It flows. And that's the quality of light that this object had. It was very large, as big as a two-story house in my estimation. And no sounds whatsoever. And we were downwind from it, so there was no humming, no whirring, no rotor sounds. It was absolutely and totally silent.
Let's come back to Ray. Ray, what kinds of physical evidence existed for this case? Was there any?
Yes, one of the typical benchmarks of these experiences is the removal of a little plug of skin just above the tibia or shin of the individual. And Jack Wiener has this scoop mark. He also had a strange lump of lipoma that appeared overnight that was diagnosed locally as a cyst, but then discovered it wasn't a cyst. He went to a doctor, and basically this is what happened. He was operated on. It was removed. The doctor told him it was going to go to the Center for Disease Control. He went back a few times and asked about it during post-operation, and not too much information was given him. But when we examined him and saw that and asked him about it, it was interesting because a number of other abductees have had these strange lumps appear overnight. And so I asked Jack to get his medical records. He went to get his medical records, and the records clerk said, "Well, you've been in the service, huh?" And Jack says, "No, I've never been in the armed services." And she says, "Well, you must have." And he says, "Well, why?" And she said that this was sent to a pathological study group in Washington, and that the study was done by an Air Force lieutenant colonel. So we thought that was very interesting. But the scoop mop is very interesting, too. I have a whole box of maybe 50 different cases involving these same scoop marks, and if you put them on the table, you can't even tell some of them apart. That they look all the same, and they're all in the same place. And this is what happened to Jack. This is one of the examples of physical evidence in this case.
You're actually saying that there is a part of our government that is well aware of these particular things being removed from abductees, and they actually send them off to some place, and then of course you can't find out what they found out. Is that right?
Well, yes and no. It's very, very hard to find out why they sent that particular sample to the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology. I was told by one person who works within a hospital situation that any strange thing like that is automatically sent there. The doctor, I think, the doctor's assistant told Jack that they did it because it would save him money, save the hospital money, and yet Jack had insurance. I called the Air Force, Armed Forces Institute of Pathology, and all they would tell me there was that they help civilian hospitals from time to time. So it's a big question mark whether this is something covert or something that was done generally. I tried to get the doctor to respond to me, and all he would do was just send me the medical record. So that's a big open question, but the scoop mark and the appearance of the lump overnight are both benchmarks of the abduction experience, and this is the type of physical evidence you have, as well as rashes in certain places. And if a UFO actually landed on someone's property, they also leave typical physical characteristics behind that match with many other cases.
All right, let me come back to the abductees, and I'm going to throw this question out to all three of you. You might want to answer in order. We could start with Charlie and move to Jack, and then finally Jim. The question I have, and of course I think a lot of listeners would like to know, did you experience pain?
Well, none that I can remember. The strongest memory I have is the emotional memory of fear and terror, I was afraid for my life. I thought that this was it, you know. I was going to just totally like disappear forever or something.
How about you, Jack?
It's very strange because my memories of being on the examination table, and they were beginning this process of poking me with this device, and the fear of it hurting was overwhelming. I remember under hypnosis thinking that this is going to hurt like crazy. And when they finally stuck me with it, it was like, oh, well, that's not so bad. And so, no, it wasn't very painful. It was almost... I felt as if I had been anesthetized, and it wasn't physical pain, but more just a fear, you know, the fear of not knowing what they were going to do next. Like Charlie said, I also felt like this was it, you know, this is the last 30 seconds of my life. I'm never going to see home again, and they're probably going to dissect me and put me in a jar somewhere. But no, for as far as pain is concerned, I don't believe there was any pain.
Jim, what was your experience?
There was one point where I actually did feel pain from them. They had this, it was not like a wand-shaped device that I remember them using it to scan Jack. It was maybe 10 inches to 12 inches long and had a little bulb on the end of it. And at one point, I had remembered them walking Jack into another adjoining room, and it was a very short, dimly lit hallway, and they had walked him through this hallway and into another room. Then they, a few minutes later, they came back for me and wanted to walk me through this same portal, and I balked. And for a moment, I mean, I just did not want to go in there. And they took this wand device, and they stuck it into my one of my ribs on the left side, and that hurt a lot. It was like they I don't know if they hit a nerve or they put it in between two of my ribs, but it really hurt a lot, and I got the clear impression that if I didn't cooperate, if I didn't do what they wanted me to do, they could make that hurt a lot more. The only moment that I remember actually experiencing pain.
All right, let me throw this open for about 5 minutes here, and feel free to jump in with anything, and I mean all of you, Charlie, Jack, Jim, and of course Ray. Let's talk a little bit about the aftermath. Ray, why don't you open that up, because you basically have some ideas, and then any one of you can jump in and talk about how this has affected your lives. So, Ray, what happens with this aftermath?
Well, a number of things can happen. Of course, we've already mentioned the fact that there are scars and rashes and things like that. But there's also the feeling of trauma, waking up from sort of a panicky situation from dreams. Some sometimes you have other external things apart from the UFO experience itself, like strange things happening with telephones, strange persons on the property, repeat abductions, so things like that happen. Plus, in some cases, a person's personality has, as far as his interest or her interest in subjects, suddenly changes dramatically. I think in the case of some of the Allagash abductees, a change in the type of painting existed in interests to computers. This is another thing that happened. Perhaps they can elaborate on some of these.
If one of you want to jump in on that, we were talking about the aftermath. How did this affect your life, Jim?
Well, boy. At first, of course, we didn't remember being abducted for a long time, for years. But what did change immediately after the encounter in Maine was, as Ray said, the type of artwork that both Jack and I were doing. Up to that time, I had been working and studying mostly as a production potter, and the type of pottery I was doing was basic traditional type vessels, pitchers, plates, that sort of thing. And immediately after we got back from the Maine trip, my work changed entirely, and I went into an entirely different direction with my concepts of form development, glaze use, surface development with the ceramics. One of the other things that suddenly appeared as one of my interests was I suddenly became interested in ancient architecture, Mayan architecture, Egyptian architecture, Southeast Asian architecture. And I don't know why. Of course, when you're an artist, you have many interests, and they evolve over time through lots of subjects. But this was something that happened immediately.
All right. How about you, Jack? What do you think happened in the aftermath to your life?
Well, it was pretty much the same as Jim. It was expressed through my artistic development, and for the experience, I was a very traditional painter. I did landscapes and still lives in a very traditional approach to my artwork. And then immediately following this experience, I stopped painting altogether, and I started becoming obsessed with geometry, architecture, grids, mathematics. All these things started influencing my artwork, and I was literally obsessed with this. And another weird thing is that I became obsessed with the Mayans, anything I could find about the Mayans. I never had any interest in any of these things before, and it just changed my whole outlook on art and mathematics, all that stuff. I used to hate math before, and after that I loved math.
And Charlie, how about you?
Well, I went from traditional type of landscape portraitures and so on, and became involved with medical art and anything to do with medicine, and so I followed it up, and that's what I do for a living now, is I'm a medical artist.
All right, so we're going to have to let the three of you go. I appreciate you being part of the show. Listen, I really am glad that you had this. It sounds to me like a lot of positive things happened for all of you.
That's right.
Thank you very much for the call. We're going to get back to Ray now, and I hope that all of you have a very, very pleasant life after this. What are your comments?
Oh, I wish this could be a lot longer, but there's so much that could be said by everybody. It's a very detailed account, and I think that I've taken the best of the 10-volume, 702-page report and compressed it into book form, and I think those who are interested in this phenomenon that seems to be happening on a large scale would be very interested in this particular case. This is in my estimation, this case is very significant. I mean, you have four very reliable witnesses who passed rigid character reference check. They're all located and cooperative in an investigation, which is very unusual. Sometimes people lose track of each other. interestingly enough, they were all artists and attended art school together and were able to actually draw a lot of the things that they had seen, and most people just can't draw, and they all relived complimentary accounts of the event. And interesting, I guess this hasn't been mentioned, that the twins we found had UFO encounters dating from early childhood. And we also documented the ongoing abductions of the twins from maybe 5 or 6 years old right up into adulthood.
Yeah, let's be clear with our listeners. Jack and Jim Weiner are the twins, so just in case people missed that.
And the scars on the twins match those and other abductees, and they pass psychological and polygraph testing, and their experiences, as we've already mentioned, correlated with similar cases. So I feel this is a very, very unique case.
Well, Ray, thank you so much. I guess there's just one quick question. Hope we can get it quickly done and have it make sense. Why do you think the government is trying to keep this UFO information secret, and what are you doing about it?
Well, there's not much I can do about it. I think any object that penetrates our airspace without permission, and especially that affects our major weapon systems, which they have, they affected Minuteman while I was working on the Minuteman projects for GTE, is automatically considered a potential threat to national security and all the regulations surrounding it. But when you have something that you don't know where it comes from, you don't know what it's doing here, and you're powerless to do something about it, this is one very powerful reason for a government to keep information quiet. They would like to acquire any hard data from the phenomena and apply it to our own weapon systems. Any injuries caused to civilians, they don't want to have to account for or be responsible for, and certainly they wouldn't want the public to know what's going on with these abduction cases. So there are a lot of good reasons. My own feeling is that mankind's evolution is being thwarted, really, in this. We've gone through things like the Copernican Revolution, which really revolutionized theology, philosophy, and everything, and I think we're going to have to go through something like that again, but much more powerful. But it's being prevented because of various interests and so forth. The Cold War is over. We don't have to fear atomic war anymore from the Soviet Union. I think it's time for the government to let more information on this whole subject out, but there's not too much we can do about it except to supply information to investigate and supply information to interested scientists and interested people around the world.
All right, once again, for those of you who are listening, Bruce Stephen Holmes, Timeless Voyager Radio. Raymond Fowler is the author, The Allagash Abductions. Thank you so much for being on the show, Ray. We have to do this again.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And I really mean we're going to do this again. There's a lot that we just touched on. I want to go further because there's a lot of important information that people should hear. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you.